from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago yesterday, Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed unarmed black teenager Michael Brown. And the race news and challenges have just kept coming. Uncovered, unleashed, old issues somehow made new, seen anew. 50 years ago tomorrow, it was Watts in L.A. going up in flames. This hour on point, a year after Ferguson, 50 years after the Watts riots, the American challenge now on race. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are we in a new era of insight, honesty, trouble, opportunity on race? How would you describe it? What do you see now, a year on, 50 years on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And we do very much keep track of those comments. Please pitch right in there. We've got a great panel with us today. Joining us first from Ferguson, Missouri, is Wesley Lowery, national reporter for The Washington Post. He's part of the new ebook, Ferguson, 3 Minutes That Changed America. Wesley, Wes Lowery, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
You were in the thick of it a year ago, became part of the story yourself when you were apprehended by police there, pulled out of a McDonald's at one point, and sort of became part of the story. You've covered a lot since then. Let's just start with yesterday, the observances of the one-year anniversary that ultimately, at least the day anyway, ended in gunfire. What did you see yesterday in Ferguson, Wesley?
Of course, there was a range of interaction, a range of activity. Yesterday, it began very peacefully. It began with a day full of vigils, a silent march from the spot where Michael Brown was shot and killed, a moment of silence for 4.5 minutes, symbolizing the 4.5 hours his body was laying on the asphalt last year. It progressed throughout the day. There were additional marches, additional demonstrations. There was a gathering in a local church, Greater St. Mark's Church, where Cornel West spoke, as well as activists participated in a panel. There was a charity rap concert downtown, which featured some prominent artists. But as nightfall began, and as some of those evening events were going on, this heavy thunderstorm actually began here in Ferguson. And during that thunderstorm, some burglaries started on West Florissant, which is the main stretch of strip malls where a lot of the protests have taken place. And as those thunderstorms started, I guess there was these groups of young men who began breaking into some of those same buildings that had been looted last year during the protest. And those burglaries prompted a police response. Police came out, many of them wearing riot gear and protective gear, attempt to stop that kind of property destruction. And then that line of police and the police shutting down of traffic then prompted additional protesters and residents, many local residents, come out of their homes and begin engaging with those officers. While it got tense for a long time, it remained relatively peaceful for several hours until in the very early morning hours, two groups of young men who happened to be off to the sides, kind of standing on the outskirts of this, got into a gun battle with each other, firing 40 to 50 shots at each other. And then a SUV full of plainclothes officers, in pursuing one of those young men, ended up getting in a gunfight with him, and that is the man who's now still hospitalized in critical condition with those gunshot wounds.
40 or 50 shots, and then more gunfire with and by police. I mean, it sounds like the Wild West, though we've heard talk of progress in this last year.
You know, I think that one of the things that's been striking is the shooting last night shows how much has changed in Ferguson and also how much has stayed the same. So here you have another black man shot, although not killed, still in critical condition, but shot in the same neighborhood right around the corner from where Michael Brown was shot. They were, in fact, high school classmates. They knew each other. You had some of the same officials, some of the same protesters and activists who last year had fled tear gas and rubber bullets and at times gunfire. We have to remember, during the protest last year, there were several nights where there was gunfire, who last night were fleeing gunfire and eventually fleeing tear gas. So much has stayed the same, and yet some things have changed. I mean, one thing that was clear was the police response. They immediately called a press conference and have been extremely forthcoming with information. A night and day difference from last year. What we remember is that one of the reasons things were so tense here last year was because no one had any information. Why was this 18-year-old dead on the ground? Why was his body out for so long?
Yeah.
What we've seen is that the police have already, and it's not even been, 10 hours since the shooting, have already released more information about this shooting than they had in the first week after Michael Brown was shot.
There's a change right there. Here last night was Ferguson's interim police chief. This is Andre Anderson. He was talking with local station KMOV about the protests when gunshots are heard. You can hear them here.
We're trying to work with the community. We're explaining to them their rights, and we just want to be as patient as possible.
Message to those who are looting.
Boom, and in come the gunshots. Wes, you've spent time in Ferguson and around the country in the years since. What do you make of the conversation that's been opened, reopened, pushed forward with this drumbeat since Ferguson?
Well, we're certainly having a much higher level and more nuanced conversation. I remember in those early days after Michael Brown was shot and killed, one of the things people were grasping for was to try to figure out what the significance of this shooting was. You had civil rights groups and some activists who were declaring that black men were being gunned down in the streets every day. You had police groups who insisted that this never happened. This is a one-off, and by the way, the guy deserved it. But it's a one-off. It never happened. What we know now is that every 9 days, an unarmed black person, an unarmed black man, is shot and killed by a police officer. That's according to an analysis that we published in the Washington Post, just 2 days ago or yesterday. What we know is that there are two people shot and killed by police, almost three people shot and killed by police, every single day. There have been 585, as of last night, fatal police shootings. And so we now have much more information about these shootings. And that empowers us to have a much deeper and more nuanced conversation about how we might end up with fewer dead people. Because everyone would prefer fewer shootings, whether it be the police, whether it be the activists, and obviously the family of those who've been killed. And so we're having a much deeper conversation, whether that's about body cameras, whether that's about de-escalation tactics, whether that's about police not necessarily having to always pursue suspects. And so we're certainly having a conversation that, in many ways, a year ago wasn't something we could even conjure up, the depth to which and at which we're still talking about.
And of course, beyond that, you hear so much more now about structural racism, about white privilege. Who would have known what a series of events and kind of stepped up conversation might have happened in this particular year since the Michael Brown incident? Here was his father over the weekend talking about his feelings after losing his son, talking with Global News Canada.
He made the movement to open up eyes to help other families.
Yes.
I still look at it, I lost, but he's still working.
Michael Brown, his memory is still working. Here was an activist, Anthony Shadid, Sunday marching to honor Michael Brown, said some police officers shouldn't be allowed to wear a badge.
If I got blood members in my family that are police, we're not talking about them. Yeah. We're talking about like-minded people like Darren Wilson.
Come on.
That's right.
They're shooting us down the streets.
That's right.
Our human rights have been violated.
Wesley Lowry is in Ferguson, Missouri. He was there a year ago. He's there today. Wes, stand by. With me in the studio right now is Farrah Stockman, columnist, member of the editorial board at the Boston Globe. She's been writing about this, thinking about this. Farrah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have written recently that we are entering a new era of race relations in America, a crazy, conflicting, potentially explosive era yet to be named. What does it feel like to you? What do you see the sun coming up on here?
I actually asked readers to name it, and I got a lot of responses. You see some polarization in this country. You see white people looking at Ferguson in a very different way than a lot of black people are looking at Ferguson and reading the Justice Department report and seeing very different things. So that's concerning. That's concerning.
Give us some examples of what people came back to you calling this new era that we're in.
So I had people saying this is the era of false equality. This is the era of racism revealed. This is the era of resegregation. So a lot of people had their eyes opened by these dash cam videos and the information that Wes was talking about that we're learning about police shootings. And so a lot of people saying, hey, things haven't changed enough, and we're frustrated by that. And then I got people writing in who clearly were coming from a more conservative perspective. One woman said, look, I'm a white woman from the South. I have no money. And mm-hmm. I think this is a second civil war. Or I think this is the era of overcompensation. And so you're really seeing some polarization here that's reflected in opinion polls. So more than half of all white people, according to some studies, think that anti-white bias is a bigger problem in the last 15 years than bias against black people. And of course, imagine, put that in comparison to what black people are seeing out there with the black men and boys being gunned down and sort of a, I'll say, a second civil rights era.
A second civil rights era. You call it what you will. Was Lowry there in Ferguson? Did you have any sense a year ago when you were covering this story that the country, I mean, there had been Trayvon Martin, there had been plenty more, but nevertheless, this last year has been unbelievable. Did you have a sense of the country being pregnant with a new surge of focus on this?
Well, it was clear from the early days that this was going to be about more than a police shooting, that this, but the anger and the unrest we were seeing on the ground was bigger than Michael Brown. That it was this big was not something we saw, you know, and so we knew, you know, maybe from the second or third day here that, you know, this was something that wasn't going to go away. There was clearly a relationship here between police officers and their community that was fundamentally broken. What we've seen replicated, though, is in city after city, those relationships are also broken. And it's taken anecdote after anecdote, whether it's in New York or Cleveland, North Charleston, and in Charleston, Madison, Wisconsin, Atlanta, down in Texas currently, where we're seeing communities that have not felt like they've had a voice, but who do feel as if their relationship with their police has been broken, now feeling empowered by the long tail of Ferguson to speak out about what they see as injustices in their own lives. And so, no, I could never have imagined that, you know, even today, 1 year later, we would be talking at the level and the depth at which we are currently about race and policing and justice in this country.
Wes Lowry in Ferguson, Missouri, national reporter for the Washington Post. I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us. We've loved your reporting. The new ebook is Ferguson, 3 Minutes That Changed America. Thank you, Wes.
Anytime.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about race in America. 1 year after Ferguson, 50 years after the Watts riots in Los Angeles, what we've learned, what we haven't, the new focus on structural racism, white privilege, black lives. Lots of people talking. Here was former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice talking with the Fox News. This was late last year about the state of race relations in America.
We're not race blind. Of course, we still have racial tensions in the country. But the United States of America has made enormous progress in race relations, and it is the best place on earth to be a minority.
Condoleezza Rice's view. But here's Ta-Nehisi Coates talking with CBS This Morning just last month about race in America.
We have made progress, but we haven't made nearly enough progress for me to feel, you know, safe in my body and for my son
and
to feel
safe in his body. And
what's
holding back that progress?
Well, I think it's us. I think it's us. And I think
who's us?
I think it's us as Americans. I think it's the country.
It's us holding back the progress. What exactly does that mean? Where do we stand? Where next? Farrah Stockman is with us from the Boston Globe, columnist, member of the editorial board there with me in the studio today. From New York, John McWhorter joins us, professor of English, comparative literature at Columbia. He wrote a piece in Time magazine headlined, What the Watts Riots Could Teach Us About Future Fergusons. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. John McWhorter, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And with us from Atlanta, Georgia, Isabel Wilkerson, journalist, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Isabel Wilkerson, welcome back to you as well. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you.
Isabel Wilkerson, you look out at the racial situation today, and for all the progress that's been made, you talk about caste, C-A-S-T-E, caste as in what we think of, what we associate with India from time immemorial. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that our country, from its founding, really has been built on a kind of caste system that we often don't see, that it's not named in that way, but it's one in which there are artificial hierarchies in which certain individuals from the very beginning were placed into a role of enslavement, and others were placed in the role of ownership. There were others in indentured servitude. And so there have always been levels of caste and hierarchies that we live with to this very day. And so that when we think about what often is called racism, the old school racism, the overt signs of racism has mutated into a new way of these continuing hierarchies that were in place long before even our great-great-grandparents were born.
John, I read you as pushing back against that way of looking at the world, certainly pushing back against looking at that as insurmountable.
Well, Tom, not exactly, and I don't mean to be contrary, but what I feel is that the main thing that has kept America from getting past race in any real way has been the relationship between the cops and particularly young black men, although things, of course, happen to black women such as Sandra Bland.
Yeah.
And I've said that for a long time, mm-hmm. and I really believe that if the relationship between the cops and black people were repaired. Listen to Ta-Nehisi Coates, for example, in the quote about his black body. That's a very common feeling. If we could get past that, then I think that the remaining instantiations of racism that are certainly there would not pain us as much. And so I think we're at a really pregnant time at this point. I can't wait to see what's going to happen now that we're having a genuine conversation. Now, the conversation isn't going the way I would prefer it to go in many ways, but the fact that we're actually talking about the cops and black people is important because that is what makes so many black people feel like this is not their country.
John, let me ask you, though, if that impasse between young black men and sometimes women as well and police, many would look at that and say, you know, that happens because of presumptions that are there in the society. When Ta-Nehisi Coates says it's because of us, I think he's suggesting that there's something in the American attitude that is empowering those police to take the actions that they act. And maybe at the same time, something frustrating some of those young black men, perhaps economically and more, that may put them in provocative circumstances.
Yeah, but we have to get past the idea that what we're trying to do is give white America a psychological makeover. And the reason is because I think that that can't happen. Yes, there are those preconceptions. If I had a magic wand, I would certainly want to use it to change thought in that way. But all you have to do is, say, read last week's New Yorker profile of Darren Wilson to see. I don't think that that magic is going to happen. But the key thing is, I don't think it's necessary. What we want to do is get the cops off of black men's necks. And frankly, teaching them about the nuances of structural racism and the fact that they don't quite see black bodies the way they see white bodies, I don't know how anybody would do that. And frankly, I don't think anybody else does. Our interest should be just in getting the cops away from these people. We can do that, especially with these cameras and with oversight boards. And when that happens, to be honest, I think that if you go fast forward about 10 years, this obsession that we have now with the idea of black people sitting in white people sitting in rooms and attesting to their privilege and all of that, that will seem a little bit recreational in a way, or it's all about a kind of a ritual. I don't think any of that's going to lead to anything, but we can still make real change, and it seems to be happening.
Isabel Wilkerson, I want to bring that to you, but Farrah Stockman, let me get you in here first. You grew up in a family with plenty of debates going on, African-American mother, white father. When you now look out at everything we've seen in the last year, if you want to get really big, go to 50 years since Watts. Is this a matter of retraining cops, or is this part and parcel or tied into structural issues that John feels some resistance toward? You know, the talk about white privilege may sound recreational one day. Or is that sitting right behind what we see in these interactions with police?
I mean, I think it's easy to lose sight of the fact that progress has been made. And that's one of the reasons that this moment right now is so uncomfortable. It's not that, I mean, it feels like there's this epidemic of police killing black men and boys. But in fact, those killings had been going on for a long time. What we know now is that there are dash cams and we can actually see these things happening. We can see these interactions and white allies can see them and be convinced that there's a problem. And so that's actually progress. We can tweet about it now. We can get our word out about it now. That's actually progress that feels like we've moved backwards. It feels less comfortable than
before. Let me just challenge it. Why is it progress? We can see it, so we could do something about it. But so far, we're just seeing it and talking about it.
Yes, but I think that I would argue that that is progress because we are doing things about it. Ferguson went and voted. They have a different government today. And after Watts, L.A. had a black mayor and a black police chief. Things have changed, but our expectations are different. We have higher expectations today than we did 50 years ago about what freedom should look like, about what American citizenship should be like. When my mother was growing up in Mississippi, segregated Mississippi, she could not attend her library. She could not go into the library of her mm-hmm. own town. Mm-hmm. So what we look at today and say is injustice, it's different than what we were calling injustice 50 years ago. We're now talking about microaggression. We talk about
microaggression, maybe, but Michael Brown is dead and he's not the only one. That's
sure,
not so micro.
Sure, but if you read the Justice Department report, mm-hmm. I think you would find that 50 years ago, you wouldn't see the reaction to Michael Brown that you're seeing today.
Isabel Wilkerson, it can be mind-boggling to try and take this full spectrum. On the one hand, we're talking microaggressions now, okay. On the other hand, you're talking about an American caste system based in no small part on race. That's not micro. That's about as macro as you can go. Are we talking about retraining cops to have better interactions between policemen and young African-American men, or are we talking about deep structural problems, Isabel?
I think part of it has to do with looking at ourselves with a little bit of distance. It's how we are seen around the world. I mean, you look at a country as large as China, where there were only 12 people, and it's unfortunate to say only, but there were 12 people killed by police in China, a country in 2014, a country that is four times the size of the United States. And that means that if we were looking at these things, you know, we have now a metronome, an incantation of names who are now household words, you might say, mm-hmm. Tamir Rice and John Crawford and Jonathan Farrell and Walter Scott and Eric Garner, all of these people who we as a country and as a world have actually seen killed before our very eyes. And if any of these things were happening in another country, we would be appalled. We would be quick to condemn and call for sanctions and for peacekeepers. I think that we've become inured to how very violent and unacceptable this has come to be. And I'd like to, you know, have us look at what the country actually is. And I so wish we knew more about our own history to be able to put it in perspective. I mean, one of the things about our current day is right now we are, you know, we are recognizing the 50-year anniversary of the Watts riot. Well, that riot, interestingly, as we know, occurred, started because of a police stop of an African American driving a 1955 Buick in Los Angeles, pulled over for reckless driving, and we know that the riots then ensued. But what's interesting about that compared to what we're looking at today is that man, Marquette Frye, was not killed.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult way to look at what really truly is progress.
I mean, we know that there are many people who are pulled over who are not killed. Nevertheless, you had that entire spark and without a death at the heart of it. We've got callers right on the subject of who's pulled over and who's not. Joshua in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Joshua, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay, I'll make this quick. So I was, I'm a black male. Mm-hmm. I lived in North Carolina for a few years, and I could cite several examples of my interactions with police officers, but I'll just cite a couple of me. Just, I lived in a predominantly white neighborhood,
okay.
And I would go jogging, and I would be pulled over several times asking, what am I doing? Do I live in the area? So I think what happened in Ferguson is just a microcosm of what's going on in society. And I just wanted to comment also on what the woman said, that change is happening because there's a black mayor. We have a black president. That means nothing. You can't legislate morality. And bottom line, it's a morality issue. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to come across bitter or angry, because I know that on both sides of the issue, there are people of goodwill and of good conscience. So I haven't lost hope. I haven't lost heart.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, you know.
Joshua, I really appreciate it. So, but tell us here. You're a black man, and you say pulled over, but you weren't even driving. You're just jogging, so you're
exactly.
stopped by police.
Exactly. Pulled over, jogging.
On the other hand, and that's no fun. On the other hand, you're living in a white neighborhood, which speaks to, now we know this isn't the norm. We still have lots of segregation, but there you were. That speaks to a kind of integration. So is this a problem with police training, or is this a deeper problem with the big us, Joshua?
It's a deeper problem because I can go into in situations that I've had with the neighbors. It's a deeper problem. And I understand that white people will never have can truly know what it is to walk in a black person's shoes. So knowing that, I have a little sympathy for them. Vice versa, I will never know what it truly is to have white privilege. So therefore, I would hope the same can be said of white folks, that they'll somehow be more understanding.
Joshua, I appreciate your call. John McWhorter, what do you make of the white privilege conversation that has grown up so robustly this year?
Everything that we're saying about white privilege is true, but I'm not sure what the conversation is for, because if white people say that they acknowledge their privilege, then that in itself leaves black people just where they were. If we say that talking about white privilege is supposed to be a prelude to activism, the fact is the way it's generally discussed, it's rather clear that the idea of just talking about it and acknowledging it is the main meal. It's considered a significant act in itself, like atoning for your original sin. I just don't see the point. What Joshua is talking about is extremely important, because that's exactly what I mean, in that if you wonder why black people talk about racism so much, it's because you're in a white neighborhood jogging and you get pulled over while jogging. Now, the question is, do white cops have to understand black history and how it feels to walk in black skin and what it is to be white privileged in order to stop pulling over people like Joshua for no reason? I don't think so. I think that something that you're calling police training very much could address that sort of thing, because it's happened in many communities across the country that necessarily we don't really hear much about right now. I think we're trying to make people perfect in a way that wouldn't work. Nevertheless, we can solve the problems that bother us.
But if there's a problem with the policeman in the street, I don't mean to minimize it by saying police training, but I do wonder if that's a matter of just that interaction, or is it evidence of a kind of thumb on the scale, if you're African-American, still in this country, that is part of the reason that leaves millions of African-Americans in poverty.
Oh, of course there's that thumb on the scale. Yes, Joshua was pulled over because somebody sees somebody with brown skin and has feelings they would not have if it was a white person going by. You can teach cops about that. You can teach them to pull back on that feeling that they have. But they can pull back on that feeling that they have and become sensitized to that kind of bias without realizing that the United States is built on the backs of black people, that when you walk in down the street as a black person, you don't think of yourself as white, and issues of this, that, and the other thing. This is a country that can barely teach anybody of any color how to read. How are we going to make all of us junior sociologists in that way? I think we can work on bias in police training. It's happened a lot, and now, thank God, it's going to happen a lot more.
Isabel, if it's cast, it sounds to me like that is a project of generations, that that the conversation would have to be a prelude to action to change it.
I'd like to believe that. I'd like to believe that just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's not necessary and not possible to try. And I'm really excited about this research that's come out in recent decades about unconscious bias and how this unconscious bias, this anti-black bias that is built into every sphere of our society and in our representations of who matters in our country, there's a recent study that came out about the representation in Hollywood and top movies, that the vast majority of people in the lead are young white men. So age, race, and gender playing a huge part in indicating to all of us subconsciously as to who matters in this country, who deserves to be in charge, who deserves to be in positions of power, and that each group beneath that has to kind of struggle to assert themselves. This unconscious bias affects all of us, the studies have found, and it means that all of us have work to do in trying to understand how it affects us and how it affects our actions.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint and you can save $50. That's casper.com/onpoint. Now back to the show.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about race in America 1 year after Ferguson, 50 years after the Watts riots in Los Angeles. What we've learned, what we haven't, the new focus on structural racism, white privilege, black lives, as in Black Lives Matter. My guests, Farrah Stockman, columnist and member of the editorial board at the Boston Globe, John McWhorter at Columbia. He wrote a piece for Time magazine recently headlined What the Watts Riots Could Teach Us About Future Fergusons. We'll ask about that. From Atlanta, Isabel Wilkerson is here, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, Pulitzer Prize winner there, and journalist. 50 years ago tomorrow, 6 days of rioting. Here's a report from The Time.
6 days of rioting in a Negro section of Los Angeles left behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities. More than 100 square blocks were decimated by fire and looters, and few buildings were left intact. Firemen were harassed by snipers and brick-throwing hoodlums as they attempted to control the fires, many of which were left to burn themselves out.
The first of many riots that would come in long, hot summers. 5 months after those riots, ABC News went back to Watts, talked with one woman who described what it was like to be living as a black woman.
It's very hard to try to explain to someone what it feels like to be black in a white world. The things that happen to you daily and that affect you and that are so much a part of you are very hard sometimes to even remember because they come so routine.
At its worst, last summer, after all the trouble in Ferguson, some people there felt that nothing had changed. Here was Stephen Wilkins talking with the PIX 11 News.
You have a picture from 2014 and a picture from 1960, and they're looking damn near identical. They got the dogs out. And there's a problem. You telling me we ain't made no progress in 50 years? My mom and them marched with Martin Luther King. You know what I'm saying? Where's the progress?
John McWhorter. Isabel Wilkerson looks at the unconscious bias and says, we've got to surface it, work on it. You write that I read you saying that's too much to expect. You've stated here today already that African-Americans shouldn't wait for a clear field or a perfect environment in which to advance. But aren't there degrees here? If there's too much bias, isn't that a formidable hurdle?
Yeah, there is. And my idea is not get over it. I mean, especially when there's too much to get over, but definitely surmount. And opinions will differ here, but my feeling is that there has been change since 1960 or 1965 in terms of what the typical attitude was. And not only has overt bigotry been outruled, but, you know, to think about, say, what the Norman Lear sitcoms like All in the Family or Maude mm-hmm. were about. And they're a historical record of how attitudes changed profoundly starting in the mid-60s to the point where socially open racism and even subtle racism. People didn't use the term white privilege at the time, but the idea was that these things were poison. Now, we've gotten to the point where you can do a psychological test and you can identify that people still have certain feelings. My feeling is that we're not going to fix that. I think that we fixed, as much as I can see it plausible, to fix a large, heterogeneous, mildly educated society. It's not that I don't want it to be fixed, but I can't see how we would do it, or at least it wouldn't be very fast. And in the meantime, I want to see change happen for real people who are having trouble in their lives. So the idea is, how do you surmount the imperfections of humanity when it gets to the point that those imperfections might be surmountable? And I think that we're at a point where if in this society we can look at those sorts of things, we can make real changes. I just question whether the strategy is to make people sit and atone for their inner psychological sins.
Atone or learn. Isabel, John writes, we are perhaps the first people on earth taught to consider it insulting when someone suggests we try to cope with the system as it is. Suggesting African Americans need to cope with the system as it is. What do you make of that?
With help from the government.
I,
I just have to say that I believe that history matters, and I think that it's important for all of us as Americans, all races, all backgrounds, all of us to know how we got to where we are. And it's because of the not knowing of how we got to where we are that many of the laws of the 1960s that were set in place to protect and to move us forward are now under attack. In other words, you know, you can change the laws, but if people do not understand why these laws are needed, we're looking at the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, which is now under assault. And so if people do not know why these laws were needed in the first place, if they're not aware of the unconscious biases that are built into the culture and the society that were there long before, that we did not want, we do not wish to have them, and even people who are African American suffer from them as well. If we do not know how we got to where we are, then the laws, as we have seen, they are not safe either. And these laws are under attack because, in some ways, the hearts did not keep pace with the circumstances that made the laws necessary. And so whatever we are doing needs to take into account that people need to know why these things are necessary, why these things are unacceptable, and to look outside of ourselves and see how the rest of the world is looking at us and recognizing that this should not be the America that we want to be.
The president saying, you've got hundreds of years of history at work here, kind of along your lines, Isabel, talking this with Mark Maron in June.
Racism, we are not cured of.
Clearly.
And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public. That's not the measure of whether racism still exists or not. It's not just a matter of overt discrimination. Societies don't overnight completely erase everything that happened 200 to 300 years prior.
50 years since Watts, we're still working on it. Marcus in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Marcus, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call today.
Mm-hmm.
I will absolutely acknowledge, I'll be the first to acknowledge that there's definitely an abuse of power within the police culture in America. It's absolutely astonishing to me that people often don't acknowledge that. Unfortunately, as a Caucasian teacher teaching within a school that's predominantly a minority and African-American population, often I find that when my students receive a poor grade after a week's worth of work, whether they've had their head down or completely not participating throughout the week, very often the first question they'll pose to me as I hand their grade over is that, is this because I'm black? And in the beginning of my teaching career, it really astonished me. As a minority myself, I grew up in a home that we did not see color. We did not, we just saw people as people. And for this question to be posed to me in the beginning of my teaching career, it really threw me. And later on, you know, I became comfortable with my position in the school. And I would jokingly say to my students, yes, it's absolutely because of the color of your skin. And they actually thought that they were posing a question to me that would throw me off, and I ended up turning it on them and throwing them off, and they just looked at me and would start hysterically laughing because they really thought that they were going to catch me. And I just found it to be so ridiculous that...
What age, Marcus? I'm just curious. What grade or what age were these students?
I would teach anything from 9th grade to 12th grade. It's an art class, and all I ask more or less for my students is to participate. I'm not expecting Picasso to be sitting in my classroom, but I'm expecting everybody to come in and work from the beginning of class to the end of class. And quite often, to be honest with you, it's not a difficult class to pass with flying colors. It's just if you put your head down and sleep the class away or have absolutely no interest in the course, then I have no other choice than to give a lower grade. And I just found it astonishing that the first question that my students would ask would be because of the color of their skin, taking no accountability for the lack of effort on their part.
But you did hear them sort of playing you there or playing with you or not?
I think it would be posed to me in a way that was very serious at first. And as my position in the school strengthened, I would play in return. And, I had enough clout with the other students that they knew where I stood and they understood that I was a very fair teacher. So it gave me the ability to turn it around and make it a very lighthearted
exchange.
Yeah, Marcus, but we've got it. I appreciate your call. Farrah Stockman, I mean, here we are. It's a funny place we're at. Part of this conversation is deadly serious, literally deadly serious. At another level, you know, here's a conversation student-teacher that is partly a game. I mean, there's something almost postmodern about the way we sometimes handle race today. How do you read the student mind who raises that question when their grade comes back low in a pretty easy course?
Well, I think this is a symptom of our half-finished racial project in America. Mm-hmm. You have students that are in this school. They feel empowered to ask that question, but I don't know.
Who knows how good the school is or what other elements of disempowerment are around them?
But I do think, while the disadvantages are very, very real, mm-hmm. very, very real, but there is a danger of concentrating so much on them that people feel hopeless and that they don't actually see a way out. They don't feel, if the message we're sending to the world is racism can never be overcome, and studies show that 48% of blacks think they will never achieve equality in their lifetime or ever. That's an incredible statistic considering how hard we fought for it and how much progress has been made. Mm-hmm. But if that's the message you're sending out to the world, you why even try? Why even try in school? And I think it's way bigger than cops, right? Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think a lot of the people who've been killed by police have been killed because of contempt of cop. They spoke back to a police officer and the police officer couldn't handle it and acted in ways that was inappropriate and escalated the situation. And I think retraining can deal with that. But it's bigger than cops. It's about education. It's about housing. Michael Brown went to the most segregated school in Missouri. Like there have been, and I think that's what's so interesting about
it. Tells you an awful lot right there.
Yeah. And I think so the problem is a lot bigger than that. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice if we just forget the great rich legacy that our ancestors taught us about self-reliance, about pulling ourselves up from our bootstraps, about the relying on the leadership and inside the black community to move us forward instead of asking always for it to come from outside.
Somebody else. Somewhere.
Yes.
Isabel, I know you're our historian here, but look ahead. What does this last year tell you about progress or the lack thereof, about whether we're moving forward towards something that's more successful or whether we are at risk as the demographics, the population of the country changes, of retreating into angry camps, more isolated?
Well, this has been such a head-spinning time in our history when you're looking at, we're seeing these videos, for example, of Walter Scott shot in the back in North Charleston, and then months later you have this massacre of 9 worshipers in Emmanuel AME Church.
Yeah.
So much we have been exposed to in just the last few months that I think that it will take us a very long time to even just adjust to and absorb all that we've been through. But I think that the force of history is leading us to this moment, a karmic moment in our country's history, a moment of reckoning. And I am so hopeful that we can recognize this as a moment where we can really try to understand how we got to this point and to move forward, and not to move in fear and sense of guilt and shame, to put all of those emotions away and to look at the fact that we have inherited a hierarchy that we still live with. We have inherited these unconscious biases that affect even how employers will hire people on the basis or even call them back on the basis of what their name sounds like. If it sounds like it's an African-American name, they're less likely to call back. These are documented inequities in our country right now, and it calls upon all of us, all Americans, to take ownership of it. Not just white people, not just black people, all Americans, because this is our country, and we can do better than this. We can be better than this.
John McWhorter, a karmic moment of reckoning. I'm somehow doubt if you're a big fan of that notion.
No. It's not that I wouldn't want there to be a karmic moment. And I think that what's going on is significant, but there's resistance. I mean, the kind of mail that I'm getting from people, not only on the right, but from the center, about my support of the Ferguson protesters and my interest in the karmicness of this moment shows me that the problem is that whether we like it or not, The thing is, if we look at history, if we look at black history, I think sometimes we're taught to assume that if we understood black history better, we'd see that black people's problems today are essentially all due to racism of various kinds. That's the lesson that many people want to teach. But the truth is, that's not all of what that history says. And I don't mean it's just our fault. I think that the history gets to be very complicated. But, and I hate to bring this up, but the fact that a Michael Brown was technically in more danger of having trouble from another black man than from a Darren Wilson. That doesn't excuse anything that
you
happened.
You mean looking at
but
statistics
in terms of black-on-black murder or what happened in Ferguson just yesterday. To tell the typical white or non-black American the reason for that is structural racism and white privilege. We're talking about such an extended kind of Rube Goldberg chain of causation that I don't think that most people are ever fully going to understand it. And they're going to think, yes, black people have problems. Yes, there's a problem with the police.
Is it that extended?
But then there's also some other stuff.
If you don't get the job interview because of your name, is that such an extended Rube Goldberg contraption?
You mean you don't get the job interview because of your name and so then you go shoot somebody in the face over sneakers? No, I think that these things are much more complicated than that. There comes a point when people say, yes, but look at what's going on in their own communities. And I don't think we can dismiss those opinions as pure racism or ignorance. We have two problems.
Farah, have we got the momentum in the right direction?
We have to fix it. We have to fix it demographically. In 30 years, whites are going to be a minority in this country. And we're going to grow old with black and brown children taking care of us, paying taxes. They're going to be in...
being who we are.
Absolutely. So we have to fix it. We don't have a choice.
Well, great to sit with the three of you on this day. A year after Ferguson, 50 after Watts. Things have changed. More change to come. Farah Stockman with the Boston Globe. Terrific work. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
John McWhorter at Columbia. Thank you for joining us again, John. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, son.
And Isabel Wilkerson in Atlanta, Georgia, author of The Warmth of Other Suns. Always wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for joining us, Isabel.
Thanks so much.
Listeners, thanks for all your thoughts today. You can continue this conversation at the onpointradio.org, on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.